In the coming week, France holds the first round of a presidential election. The Stand Up for Ukraine pledging event takes place in Warsaw, and Pakistan faces a constitutional crisis. It's April 7th, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, this Sunday, April 10th, French voters are set to head to the polls to vote in a pivotal presidential election. Early polling predicts that current French President Emmanuel Macron's most formidable challenger will be French National Assembly member Marine Le Pen. Close watchers of this upcoming election in France anticipate the election will move to the second round showdown between the center-left Macron and the far-right Le Pen. Tell us more about the players and the significance of this election in France right now, Bob.
Sure, Jim. Well, let me just stress that under the French electoral rules, if no candidate gains an outright majority in the first round of voting, which is what's taking place this weekend, the top two candidates move on to a second round of voting in which the winner must clear 50%. And as you indicated, Macron and Le Pen are polling pretty clearly in the top two. So people are already jumping ahead to a neck and neck race with them. But
neither one is scoring a majority in the polls.
Neither scoring a majority. And we're looking at a French electoral landscape that the big story is, and it's really reaching a crescendo coming up to this vote, is the rise of the French right. So Le Pen is in some cases seen to be gaining ground in just head-to-head polling with Macron because she is seen as more moderate, as a softer right-wing candidate than Eric Zemmour, who's taken over the farther right of the French political landscape. And he has been very sort of staunchly anti-immigrant. He's had strong things to say about keeping out Ukrainian immigrants, for example, whereas Le Pen actually organized a trip of supporters to go to Poland and embrace Ukrainian immigrants and so forth and try to present a softer side while she still very much holds up, you know, this sort of cultural populism and a French sort of right of center, actually farther right of center stance on what it means to be French. Whereas Macron has been this center candidate, center left, a little bit center right, certainly center right in his first term in office. We'll recall he kind of blew up the French political establishment when he was elected 5 years ago as this new face, this new movement. You've seen the socialists in France, which for years were a dominant party, and the Republicans both really declined quite a bit as Macron sort of carved out this middle ground, partly because of concern about Le Pen. And she was pretty much trounced in the previous election. But as often happens, you have an incumbent in power who the more people see of him, people come up with all sorts of resentments. It doesn't help. Like in many other places where you have incumbents facing challenges, that there are economic issues at stake. We should note the Gilets Jaunes movement, the Yellow Vest movement, was against Macron, was against economic policies, increasing energy bills and so forth, gas prices, and there's inflation, there's the response to COVID and so forth, and incumbents are taking a backlash on that, Jim. So I would just say that you have Macron sort of holding on. He's carving out also a statesman's role in the middle of the Ukraine crisis. Not clear what that kind of gets him at the polls in France, but it's all leading up to a very compelling vote in France.
Bob, there's a lot there, so let me just pick off one aspect of what you said, and that is, why have we seen a decline, an almost disappearance of what had been traditionally the two main political parties in France, the Socialist and in the latest iteration, the Republicans? They're nowhere. What happened? Normally, you don't see two large dominant parties just essentially get pushed to the margins.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think people may forget the situation when Macron emerged 5 years ago, and also, again, when Marine Le Pen was seen as a potentially viable candidate, because the two main parties, the mainstream parties, had become embroiled in corruption scandals of various sorts. And so their main flag carriers or standard bearers, you know, had contributed to that decline. And then you do have the combination of incumbency in the case of Macron and the seizing of the narrative by the right. And there's all sorts of reporting and commentary going on about what is happening culturally in France, how much it reflects outside developments, whether it's in Europe or the United States, as much as a sense of French identity. Again, there's this term, the anti-wokeism. There's a French term for that that sounds very similar, but that echoes the concerns or the debate playing out in the United States about policies seen as too liberal, too progressive, that are foreclosing the views of a traditional, in the United States case, you know, white majority voters and citizens. In France's case, there's been a growing concern about the existing immigrant population, Jim, a lot of Muslims from North Africa, for example. And it seems like the French right's galvanizing behind this kind of narrative has gained traction. And there are these simmering resentments about the EU, about EU controls over domestic affairs, which have burbled up in many publics recently, whether it was, you know, in the course of debt concerns several years ago, or COVID responses, or immigrant or migrant responses. All of these things have conspired to kind of blow up some of the traditional parties. We've seen this happen in other countries too, Jem, but in France, I think it's that combination of anti-establishment cynicism with the corruption and the sort of the same old. And Macron's getting a little taste of that as well. There's a sense among some opinion surveys we're seeing of him being sort of typical part of the French elite. He hasn't really changed that score much at all. And so those who resent him really resent him. But by the same token, Marine Le Pen represents something that I'm not sure how many French are comfortable with, which is what makes this so compelling.
Oh, help me understand this, Bob, because I'm getting a bit of whiplash from following the French public opinion polls. If I were to go back 3 months or 4 months ago, what I was reading and seeing was that Zemmour was sort of surging and that he was the darling of the moment. Then we have the Ukraine crisis, and I see President Macron sort of asserting the traditional French Gaullist leadership role. He's going off to Moscow. He's talking about trying to shape the debate. And of course, the invasion breaks out, and I hear a lot of people talking about how this is going to be basically a shoo-in for Macron because the focus is going to be on foreign policy, and he's sort of fulfilling the French vision of magisterial presidential leadership. But then in the span of 3 weeks, 4 weeks, all of a sudden I'm hearing that Marine Le Pen is now a real threat to Macron's re-election. So what's going on, and are we going to see another flip over the next couple of weeks?
Well, there's some people, to that last question, Jem, some people are warning about, you know, you could see a sort of a radical game changer take place in French politics, a la Trump beating Clinton or British voters voting for Brexit, you know, in terms of Marine Le Pen emerging in a second round vote with consolidation of right and center right enough that she can defeat Macron. And then you have a France suddenly with a Euroskeptic leader and, you know, all bets are off. It's not clear. I will say that the narrowing does seem to reflect in some ways her deft response to the Ukraine crisis. I think it was jarring for people in France as across the continent to see the unprovoked shelling of civilian populations and neighborhoods by Russians. And those resonated, and the response tended to hit Zemmour and on the farther right harder than Le Pen, who again was trying to strike more of a softer ground. We see potentially some echoes in the way Viktor Orban, just reelected in Hungary, responded, where he accepted hundreds of thousands of refugees from neighboring Ukraine, but also maintained his role as sort of the candidate of stability and peace, and also kind of balanced out his country's NATO membership with his relationship with Russia. Le Pen has been more trying to be more proactive in terms of sympathetic, encouraging voice vis-a-vis Ukrainian refugees, whereas Zemmour has doubled down on his hard line on immigrants and saying we shouldn't just use this to open the door. And I think that struck people the wrong way. So I guess it's this calculation, perhaps, Jem, and this is speculation, that some friends thought, you know, I really can't stand Macron, but Le Pen used to worry me. Now she doesn't worry me as much, and maybe I'll throw my hat in with her. These things always take on a life of their own as we get into a second round, as people start to gauge their calculations. But I will say that there's this huge amount of speculation now that the French right could be making a move that we haven't seen in that country in this fashion before.
I'm probably getting ahead of myself here, Bob, but what good is a podcast if you can't get ahead of yourself? What would it mean if Marine Le Pen were elected president of France? What is her agenda? How different would it be, in particular, given what's happening in the world today, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the importance of NATO, Western solidarity? Would Le Pen reaffirm that, or would she provide a new source of division?
That is a crucial question, Jem. Certainly, as it regards the EU, you could very much see a different calculus for France. Now, this is the second largest economy in the EU, which is France, and she has been skeptical, if not hostile, towards the EU and on a number of pronouncements. Some have used the term Frexit as a potential option for France. I'm not sure how clear that is. You sometimes have candidates in other countries in Europe who've made noises like that and then backed away.
Well, it's easy to run against Brussels because it's
easy to run against
distance place. You can blame everything on what Brussels did.
NATO is another issue where you could see sort of Trumpian overtones, where there's a lot of skepticism towards NATO and towards following the NATO lead vis-a-vis Russia in particular. And so that opens up all sorts of complex possibilities. Again, this would completely upset decades and decades of post-war French foreign policy. So I'm not sure how sort of abruptly we'd see any of this change. She has, by many accounts, Jem, fashioned herself as this candidate representing the working class French, sort of lower middle class. And so taking policies that would somehow ease what they're facing in terms of energy costs, in terms of, inflation and so forth. What does that mean? It means you see more government involvement. You see more debt accumulation, potentially. You see more protectionism, potentially. potentially. I think we're looking at that, and that's a playbook that we've seen from other populists, Jim. And so some sort of an amalgam of that potentially is what's in store. Again, getting ahead of ourselves a little bit.
I have to ask one last question, Bob, since you mentioned Russia. Any signs that the Russians are taking a page out of their playbook in trying to interfere in the election and potentially tip the balance toward Madame Le Pen?
I think we can certainly expect the Russian playbook to play out in these elections as they have in others. I haven't seen any glaring examples of it. I know that the French have been extremely careful of trying to counter any kind of mass disinformation campaigns going on, and they may have been successful. It certainly was the case in previous elections in France, as in other places in the continent. But I think we should keep an eye on that front, especially heading into this weekend, for any kind of, you know, alarming moves. Potentially, the Russians are waiting for a second round to really weigh in on that. So that's something to watch.
We will have to pay attention and see what happens.
Jim, I want to stay on the continent, though, and take our conversation to Warsaw, where the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau are going to co-host the Stand Up for Ukraine pledging event. So the aim of the conference, which is Saturday, April 9th, is to get governments and corporations to pledge humanitarian aid to UN groups and help Ukrainian refugees and internally displaced people, a number that has surpassed 11 million now, Jim. Can you tell us a bit more about the event this weekend?
Certainly, Bob. As you point out, the goal of Saturday's Stand Up for Ukraine pledge event is to get governments, corporations, and individuals to pledge aid to the Ukrainian government, to UN groups, and to nonprofits like Global Giving. The whole idea is to try to help internally displaced people within Ukraine. Those are people who have been forced out of their homes and their villages, towns, and cities, but remain in Ukraine, but also to help Ukrainian refugees, that is, people who have crossed the border into other countries. As you know, the number is very high. There's some 7 million internally displaced people in Ukraine. Best guess is more than 4.3 million Ukrainians have left Ukraine. Some 2.5 million have entered Poland. It's not clear that all of them have stayed in Poland. I think some of them have gone off to other countries, Germany, France, elsewhere. Now, this pledging event is supposed to be in a live roundtable format, and it's being hosted in Warsaw in recognition of the fact that Poland has received so many Ukrainian refugees. Now, tomorrow, Friday, April 8th, that is the day before the Stand Up for Ukraine pledge event, there is going to be a global social media rally, which is designed to call attention to the pledging event and to solicit donations for Ukraine. As I understand it, that rally is going to consist of videos and posts from activists who are on the front lines, from artists and celebrities like U2, Celine Dion, Ellen DeGeneres, Hugh Jackman, and a lot of other, you know, Hollywood A-listers. And of course, all of this is taking place against the horrifying news that came out this week of the massacres and atrocities in the town of Bucha, a suburb of Kyiv, that has really, I think, inflamed passions in Ukraine and beyond, again, reviving talk about Vladimir Putin as a war criminal, talk about how we can prosecute him and the like. Now, of course, as you know, Bob, it's easy to label Putin a war criminal, and it's easy to point to how the actions of Russian soldiers have violated international law. But it's a whole other question of how you can effectively penalize leaders for doing so.
So, Jim, we should understand this aid effort as maybe more in the temporary zone of maintaining the life and livelihood of all these people who've been disrupted. And not, this is separate from, say, some sort of a reconstruction aid, because, first of all, the war is not over. But when you see these cities, city after city, just reduced to rubble, that raises the specter of there's going to be massive amounts of aid needed in the future. For now, though, we're talking about food, shelter, basics.
You're quite right, Bob. If you look at Ukraine itself, there will eventually be need for some kind of Marshall Plan to rebuild Ukraine. But you can't begin rebuilding as long as you have continued fighting. So that's a very real problem and sticking point. And the reality is that the fighting could go on for quite some time. There's no evidence to indicate that the Russians, despite their willingness to go to the table and negotiate, are actually willing to negotiate, or that they're willing to offer anything that would be remotely acceptable to the government of President Zelensky. So what's happening on the ground is likely to continue, and that really requires us to think about how that might play out. You could be seeing even more refugee flows leaving Ukraine, more internally displaced people. Again, it appears that the Russians are now going to be concentrating their military efforts in the Donbas and trying to solidify gains there and take over both of the two independent republics they recognized back in February, Luhansk and Donetsk. And one of the things that they could do is end up pushing people out of those areas who oppose impose Russian rule, which could exacerbate the problem. But leaving that aside, again, the pledge agreement is really focused on the fact that you have people who don't have jobs, don't have access to food, don't have access to shelter, and there's just a giant humanitarian need that has to be addressed here. And it's going to, again, apply to people who are both living in Ukraine, IDPs, internally displaced people, but also to refugees. Now, don't be surprised if this big effort then leads to criticism from people elsewhere in the world, particularly in the global south, saying there are humanitarian catastrophes in many other places. We've talked about them before, Bob. What's happening in Ethiopia, the situation in Yemen, Syria, Myanmar, the list goes on. And people will complain, why isn't the world, or really why isn't the West, rallying to help those people who are in equally or worse situations?
Well, and we should also know, Jim, that it's important you raise the rest of the world situation too, because nothing's happening in a vacuum. But you have, even with its problems, a UN Security Council that in previous years, even with divisions, was taking action, was setting up peacekeeping missions, trying to provide, let's say, humanitarian aid corridors, whatever, to many conflicts. Syria was a case where we really saw serious divides playing out in ways that unfortunately are echoing now in Ukraine. But prior to that, you would have the Security Council taking action, and it still meets and it still has on its agenda action on a lot of conflicts and dire humanitarian situations to try to empower moves that can feed people, that can create safe areas in war zones, whatever. We're seeing these almost unprecedented sharp frictions playing on the Security Council with Russia as a permanent veto-wielding member pitted against the U.S. You've had Ukraine's President Zelensky addressing the Security Council directly from a video hookup and pointing out via video and via testimony what has happened to civilian areas of the country. And all of this has just created huge questions about the legitimacy of the UN Security Council. As we're taping this podcast, I believe the UN General Assembly was voting on whether to oust Russia from the UN Human Rights Council, Jim. So it's happening at a time when there's a systemic overload or systemic fracturing going on that it can't help the situation.
What Russia's invasion of Ukraine has highlighted, Bob, is a lesson that has been with us since the founding of the United Nations. And that is, when one of the veto-wielding members of the UN Security Council is opposed to action, you get inaction. And that, in a sense, baked into the structure from the very beginning. And so the UN has always been limited. It can only do what its members, particularly its most powerful members, wanted to do. So on this issue, it has been reduced to the level, at least at the UN General Assembly and the Security Council, of being a debating forum. Some of those debates have been quite emotional, quite dramatic. Think of the remarks by the Kenyan ambassador at the outset of the Russian invasion, in which he denounced just another version of colonialism. But the institutions themselves have not been able to mandate security or peace or negotiations, ceasefires, and truces. Having said that, the UN system, variety of organizations involved in relief work and the rest, have been very active and do provide very real, profound benefits in Ukraine and elsewhere. So while we criticize the UN for not, quote, solving the problem, there are a number of UN agencies who are deeply involved in actually trying to alleviate, to the extent they can, given the budgets they have, the real human suffering in Ukraine and elsewhere. That takes us back to the pledging event, because again, part of the pledging event is to get people to give money to UN organizations to help them be better able, better resourced to do their job.
It's a really good point about what the UN is. It's not any one thing. It is a whole host of different things that, if it didn't exist, would probably be created to deal with these circumstances. And they're really active. World Food Program, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and so on. And there's also agencies that seem to do work that countries take offense at because they are poking around into their actions and whether or not those actions are breaking international laws, if not norms.
Well, I think a lot of international laws and norms are being broken by the Russians in Ukraine. And one of the really interesting things is, I think these atrocities, the war crimes, the actions are going to be very well documented, not just by governments, but also by private sector groups. It's really remarkable how much has been done using open source information to track what has happened. I did a podcast with Audrey Kurth Cronin, a professor at American University, for the President's Inbox, where he sort of delved into this. And it's really remarkable how much is being done by organized groups, but also by individuals who are horrified by what they're seeing and want to document for history what is being done.
No, it's fascinating. We'll see how much interest and energy can be applied towards the next pledging conference. And again, it's a moment for governments, private sector, and NGOs to really step up.
Bob, let's shift gears and let's talk about Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan dissolved Pakistan's National Assembly this week in and called for new elections. This blocked a no-confidence vote that was widely expected to push him out of the prime minister's office. This gives us a constitutional crisis in Pakistan. Many people worry that Prime Minister Khan's latest move could potentially destabilize what is quite clearly a fragile democracy and one that has a nuclear arsenal to boot. So can you just sort of set the table for us, Bob? What are the issues? Where do we think this is headed?
Jim, I should note, as we're taping this podcast, sometimes we get caught up in fluid moments, and this is one of them. The Supreme Court of Pakistan is expected to rule on it in the course of today, so Thursday. So what we say, you know, is sort of conditioned on the fact that, you know, the court may go in one direction or another. But
do we know what the court will rule on, Bob? The legitimacy of Khan's decision, something else?
My understanding is it's directly his decision to dissolve parliament as he was facing a vote of no confidence. The court could simply say, no, parliament has the right to hold such a vote and it should go forward. If so, it seems like the votes exist that would clearly create a no confidence measure against Khan, and we'd go from there and have a leadership change in Pakistan.
Well, I would note that would continue a practice that has bedeviled Pakistani politics since it moved toward a democratic form of government, which is no prime minister has ever served out a full five-year term. I believe it's a five-year term as prime minister.
Yes, exactly. And Khan was supposed to be different. He was supposed to be this person, this unifying figure, let's note it as everybody does, a former world-class cricket star who had campaigned nationwide and had seemed to have extraordinary support across the country, not just from a power base in, let's say, Punjab, as some of the politicians have emerged in the past. But he had increasingly started to run afoul of coalition partners and of the very important Pakistani military, which was, by many accounts, becoming more and more concerned about some of his foreign policy decisions. In particular, he had embraced the rise and resurgence of the Taliban, for example, in neighboring Afghanistan. Not that Pakistan hasn't supported the Taliban, but they sort of support it in their sort of their own fashion, let's say. But also the embrace of China and what some in the military in particular have seen is too much of a reliance on China. Pakistan is part of the Big Belt and Road Initiative, for example. Khan appeared in Moscow the day of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, exchanging, warm pleasantries with Vladimir Putin on that day. So I think these things have added up in addition to other matters, the economic functioning. We'll get back to the economy again and again. Country has huge problems resulting from fuel prices going up, the COVID-related troubles, inflation, and so forth. And Khan is seen as not being able to handle it. And on top of it all, Jim, he goes ahead and facing what appeared to be almost a certain vote of no confidence. He works with the parliament speaker to dissolve parliament and then talks about holding new elections with the assumption that he could do better appealing directly to the Pakistani people than in trying to deal with political coalitions that are working through the constitutional ways that they are supposed to work through. So the Supreme Court is sitting there with a very important decision. And as you say, yet again, Pakistan looking like it's dealing with a turbulent leadership turnover. I should add one other thing. There's a familiar family name sort of looming in the form of Shahbaz Sharif, brother of Nawaz Sharif, former Pakistani prime minister. And he is assumed to be someone poised to take power in the event of a, no confidence vote, for example, against Khan.
Bob, any sense where the Pakistani military is in all of this? I mean, it's long been alleged that the Pakistani military has really been the power behind the prime ministership and has used its clout to steer Pakistani politics.
Yeah, I think they had initially been a pretty strong supporter of Khan's civilian administration. And it's now seeming like they're kind of done with that. They are not happy with some of his recent moves. And so you could see the military throwing its weight overtly behind an opposition coalition to move ahead and to take power. And maybe you have more of a military in the forefront. Again, this sort of tenuous civilian-run Pakistan has always survived because of the strong military there, ready to lend support when necessary. And I think you're looking at a moment where the military is ready to kind of assert itself again. At least that's what the people who follow Pakistan closely, they say that there's a perception that the military leadership has now distanced itself from Khan. And because of that, it boosted the opposition and it sort of emboldened this move towards a no confident vote. And so the military is playing a role in it, and it plays its hand very closely. And it plays its hand, especially when it deals with foreign policy and, of course, national security. It plays that role very overtly. So, it seems like it has made a move. It has lost confidence in Khan, and therefore, given its role in the country, Khan's days would appear to be numbered.
Well, we're going to have to keep an eye on this, Bob, because whenever you have political instability or turmoil in a country that has nuclear weapons, it's a reason for concern.
Absolutely. And Pakistan, it always comes back to that, right? It's a country that has these tricky balancing act of a military and a nuclear armed arsenal. It's got a strong Islamist base, and it's got a very activist Islamist population, especially in the north and west, and a very raucous political scene. And so we should also add, Jim, that, you know, it's happening at a time of ferment elsewhere in South Asia. Sri Lanka is dealing with extraordinary protests now as well against their kind of ruling dynasty. And so we could be looking at South Asia with the economic underpinnings of this all, this roiling moment of, you know, economic strife, response to COVID, food shortages, some of which is a knock-on from Ukraine, which we talked about earlier. All of this seems to be of a piece now, Jim. We are just looking at an incredible chapter right now of instability, and it's going to require steady hands to try to see through, but it's not sure whether the Supreme Court in Pakistan is going to be able to help assert that.
Certainly no shortage of destabilizing factors, Bob.
No. Well, maybe we can find some stability in the audience figure of the week, Jim, which our listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected AUKUS pledges hypersonics. Jim, I think I know what that means, but could you tell us a little bit about the significance?
Happy to do so, Bob, but I don't think it's going to deliver any sense of greater calm or stability. Before we sort of dive into this, perhaps we should do a primer on what exactly a hypersonic is. When we do that, think of two words, speed and maneuverability. Hypersonics are missiles that fly at least 5 times the speed of sound, Mach 5, if you want to use the lingo. That means they travel faster than 3,836 miles per hour. These missiles basically come in two types, ballistic and cruise missiles. Ballistic missiles, as we normally think of them, intercontinental missiles, are already hypersonic. They travel more than Mach 5. But with a traditional ballistic missile, it is like throwing a baseball. The original launch speed and angle will determine where the missile lands. With a hypersonic missile, it has the added advantage of being able to maneuver upon reentry. Why are you designing these so-called hypersonic glide vehicles? Because you want to be able to elude missile defenses. Now, hypersonic cruise missiles don't leave the atmosphere the way that most ballistic missiles do. What they do is they fly low and they fly extremely fast, and they fly so fast that there's really no reaction time for defenses, or defenses simply don't have the ability to catch the missile when it's launched. Now, I should note two things. One is that a hypersonic missile can carry a conventional or a nuclear payload. Second thing is they're really hard to build, and they're really hard to build precisely because you want them to go fast and you want them to be able to maneuver. And when missiles, whether they're ballistic or cruise missiles, are traveling at very high rates of speed, you generate a lot of heat as the vehicle passes through the air. Friction builds up and would normally melt most kinds of metals. That's why these missiles involve very exotic composites. Now, Russia allegedly used a hypersonic missile last month to target sites in Ukraine last month. Now, those missiles use conventional warheads, and there's some debate about whether or not the Russians really used a hypersonic missile. Even if they did, I think most people who are in this business would say what they were using was really, in a sense, an older generation of technology, not the new kinds of hypersonics that are available. And of course, if the Russians did use a hypersonic missile to target a weapons depot in western Ukraine, it would mark the first use in warfare of hypersonic missiles. Now, the Chinese have been investing very heavily in hypersonics. They conducted several tests last year that caused a lot of Western defense analysts to stand up and take notice, because it seemed as if the Chinese had really sort of leapfrogged where many Western militaries are.
General Milley called it a Sputnik moment.
He most certainly did. I think it was noted at the Pentagon, and they're busy devising a response. Okay, so that's the background. Sorry to be so long-winded. What happened this week, essentially, is that the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom announced that they're going to collaborate on developing both types of hypersonic missiles, and also on ways to counter them. This announcement garnered a lot of news. We have AUKUS, this agreement among the Americans, the Brits, and the Aussies to work more closely on things, and obviously that's perceived as being aimed at China. But I think there's a little bit less here than meets the eye. First, the United States has been working on hypersonics for a while. Indeed, the U.S. military tested one last month, and the United States and the Australians have already been collaborating on hypersonic missile research. The really new element here is that Britain is joining in, but I think it's important to emphasize that neither Australia nor Britain has pledged to actually build hypersonic missiles. I will note they're very expensive, and their utility is probably limited to a very small number of military objectives. You can accomplish a lot with more traditional missiles, whether cruise or ballistic. ballistic. Just one final point here. When we look at hypersonic missiles, Bob, it's just another example of what happens when you have arms race competition. Countries like China are developing hypersonics because they're concerned that U.S. missile defenses would be able to essentially neutralize their ballistic missile force, and that would leave them vulnerable. So what do? They try to develop technology that will beat American defenses. Americans see these efforts to try to beat their defenses. So now they're going to invest a lot of money to make sure that, one, they can counter these efforts to evade their defenses, but also to have the same kind of capability so they can pose similar threats to others. And so you get into this arms race competition. And it takes us back to the bigger issue of why so many people championed arms control back in the 60s and 70s into the 80s. It was a way of sort of limiting these sort of pressures. And again, a big issue, been much talked about, is can you somehow revive arms control for the 21st century? And the answer so far has been, doesn't look very good on that score, partly because of tensions among the great powers, but also because in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you were talking about a bipolar world. There were just two parties, the United States and the Soviet Union. Now you have really at least a tripolar world, the United States, Russia, and China, but also gets more complicated because each of those countries worries about others. So, for example, the Chinese worry not just about the United States, but about what it is that India has. And India, of course, worries about not just what China has, but what Pakistan has. So you have these sort of interlocking triangles, which really complicate any effort to sort of figure out how you can control this stuff.
Jim, you were right. The audience figure did not reassure this week, but thanks nonetheless for the explanation. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Germany's Chancellor Scholz visits London to meet with British Prime Minister Johnson. The anniversary of the New START Treaty being signed between the United States and Russia is marked. And a presidential recall referendum takes place in Mexico.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. As always, Zoe, thank you very much. Special thanks goes out to Margaret Gatch, Nicholas Martinez, and Rafael Seward for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.